9. I was hoping for an early night, but Arkady had asked me to a barbecue with some friends on the far side of town. We had an hour or more to kill. We bought a bottle of chilled white wine from the off-license. Arkady lived in a rented studio apartment above a row of lock-up garages in the lot behind the supermarket. The metal rail of the stairway was still hot from the sun. The air conditioner was on, and as he unlocked the door, a cool draught blew in our faces. There was a note shoved through onto the mat. He switched on the light and read,
"Not before time," he mumbled.
"What's that?" I asked. He explained how one of the KTG elders, a man called Alan Nakamura, had been holding up the survey for the last 4 weeks. He was the last male survivor of his clan and traditional owner of the country north of Middle Boar Station. The railway surveyors had been champing to peg out this particular stretch of track. Arkady had put them off till Alan could be found.
"Where did he go?"
"Where do you think?" he laughed.
"He went walkabout."
"What happened to the others?"
"Which others?"
"The others of his clan."
"Shot," said Arkady, "by police patrols in the 20s.
The room was neat and white. There was a juice extractor on the bar of the kitchenette and a basket of oranges beside it. Some Indonesian cloths and cushions were strewn over a mattress on the floor. Pages of sheet music, of the well-tempered clavier, lay open on top of the harpsichord. Arkady uncorked the bottle, poured 2 glasses, and while I glanced at the contents of his bookshelf, he put through a call to his boss. He talked business for a minute or two, and then said there was this pom in town who wanted to go out bush with the survey team. No, not a journalist. Yes, as poms went, relatively harmless. No, not a photographer. No, not interested in watching rituals. No, not tomorrow, the day after. There was a pause. You could almost hear the man thinking on the far end of the line. Then Arkady smiled and gave a thumbs-up sign.
"You're on," he said, and replaced the receiver.
He next called the truck hire company to have a vehicle for Wednesday morning.
"Make it a Land Cruiser," he said. "We might get rain."
On the bookshelf there were Russian classics, books on the pre-Socratics, and a number of Aboriginal studies. Among the latter were 2 of my favourites, Theodor Strelo's Aranda Traditions and Songs of Central Australia. Arkady opened a tin of cashew nuts, and we both sat cross-legged on the mattress.
"Na zdrovya."
He raised his glass.
"Na zdrovya."
We clinked glasses. He unfolded his legs once more, pulled a photo album from the shelf, and started turning the pages. The first pictures were all colour snapshots, mostly of himself, the record of any young Australian on his first trip overseas, Arkady on a beach in Bali, Arkady at Kibbutz Hulda, Arkady beside the temple at Sunyan, Arkady with his wife-to-be in Venice, with pigeons, Arkady back in Alice, with the wife and baby. He then flipped to the back of the album, to a faded black-and-white picture of a youngish couple on a ship's deck with a lifeboat in the background.
"Mum and Dad," he said. "May 47, when the ship docked at Aden."
I leaned forward to get a close look. The man was short, with a flat, powerful body, solid black eyebrows and slanting cheekbones. A wedge of dark hair showed in the neck of his shirt. His baggy trousers were cinched in at the waist and looked several sizes too big. The woman was taller and shapely, in a simple smock dress, and had pale hair tied up in braids. Her plump arm bulged over the stanchion rail. They screwed up their faces to the sunlight. Lower down the same page, there was a second photo of the man, shrunken and grey now, standing beside a wicket fence, in a garden of cabbages that could only be Russian cabbages. Beside him, forming a group, were a round peasant woman and 2 young bruisers in caracul hats and boots.
"That's my auntie," said Arkady. "Those are my Cossack cousins."
The caracal hats took me back to a stifling summer afternoon in Kiev, and the memory of a squadron of Cossack cavalry exercising down a cobbled street. Glossy black horses, scarlet capes, high hats worn at an angle, and the sour, resentful faces of the crowd. The date was August 1968, a month before the invasion of Czechoslovakia. All through that summer, there had been rumours of unrest in the Ukraine. Arkady refilled the glasses, and we went on talking of Cossacks, of Kazakh and Cossack, the Cossack as mercenary and Cossack as rebel, of Yermak the Cossack and the conquest of Siberia, of Pugachev and Stenka Razin, Makhno and Budeni's Red Cavalry, I happened to touch on von Panvitz's Cossack Brigade, which fought for the Germans against the Soviet army.
"Funny you should mention von Panvitz," he said.
In 1945, his parents had found themselves in Austria, in the British-occupied zone. It was a time when the Allies were sending Soviet refugees, traitors or otherwise, back home to the mercy of Stalin. His father was interrogated by a British intelligence major who accused him, in faultless Ukrainian, of fighting for von Panvitz. After a week of intermittent interviews, he succeeded in convincing the man that the accusation was unjust. They were moved on to Germany, where they were billeted in what had been an officers' club, below the Eagle's Nest at Berchtesgaden. They applied for emigration papers to the United States and Canada. Argentina, they were told, was a better bet for people of doubtful status. At last, after a year of anxious waiting, there came news of jobs in Australia and passages for the ones who signed. They took the chance, gladly. All they wanted was to get away from a murderous Europe, from the cold, mud, hunger, and lost families, and come to a sunny country where everyone ate. They sailed from Trieste on a converted hospital ship. Every married couple was segregated on the voyage and could only meet in daylight on deck. After landing at Adelaide, they were interned in a camp of Nissen huts, where men in khaki barked orders in English. Sometimes they thought they were back in Europe. I had noticed earlier something fierce in Arkady's obsession with Australian railways. Now he explained himself. The job assigned to Ivan Volchok was to work as a maintenance man on the transcontinental line in the middle of the Nullarbor Plain. There, between the stations of Xanthus and Kitchener, without wife or children, driven crazy by the sun and the diet of bully beef and billy tea, he laboured at the work of replacing sleepers. One day they brought him back to Adelaide on a stretcher. The doctors said heat exhaustion, and the railway paid no proper compensation. Another doctor said, "You've got a dicky heart." He never worked again. Luckily, Arkady's mother was a capable and determined woman, who, starting with a street stall, built up a prosperous fruit and vegetable business. She bought a house in an eastern suburb. She read Russian novels to herself, Russian folk tales, to Alkasha and his brothers, and took them on Sundays to Orthodox Mass. Her husband had none of her resources. He had once been all muscle and rebellion. With age, he would shuffle round the shop, get in everyone's way, get drunk on his homemade hooch, and gloomily brood on the past. He would mumble incoherently about a pear tree in his mother's garden and of some amulet he had hidden in the fork. Trees, he said, were half dead in Australia. In Russia there were real trees, which shed their leaves and came alive again. One evening, Arkady's brother Petro found him hacking down their Norfolk Island pine. They knew then that things were seriously wrong. Through the Soviet embassy in Canberra, they got permission for him and Petro to go back and visit his village, Gornyatskaya. He saw his sister, the old samovar, wheat fields, birches, and a sluggish river. The pear tree had been cut down long ago for firewood. In the cemetery, he cleared the burdock from his parents' grave and sat listening to the squeak of the rusty weather vane. After dark they all sang, his nephews taking turns to play the family bandura. The day before their departure, the KGB took him to Rostov for questioning. They went over and over his dossier and asked a lot of tricky questions about the war. "Dad," said Arkady, "was happier to see Vienna this time than the last." This had happened 7 years ago. Now, once again, he was yearning to go back to Russia. He now talked of nothing but the grave at Gornyatskaya. They knew he wanted to die there, and they didn't know how to arrange it. "Even as a Westerner," I said, "I know how he must feel. Whenever I've been to Russia, I can't wait to get away. Then I can't wait to go back."
"You like Russia?"
"The Russians are wonderful people."
"I know that," he answered sharply. "Why?"
"Hard to say," I said. "I like to think of Russia as a land of miracles. Just as you fear the worst, something wonderful always happens."
"Such as?"
"Small things, mostly. Humble things. Humility in Russia is endless."
"I believe you,"
he said.
Come on, we'd better get going.